This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. Georgia Hargreaves here with you again today for the Country Hour. Thanks for tuning in online on the ABC Listen app. Still to come between now and the news at 12:30, you're going to hear more on the shutdown of the Pilbara to demersal trawl industry, and you'll hear some of the concerns about what that might mean for the supply of other seafood like prawns and scallops. And a bit later, have you ever tried a Kakadu plum? Well, the market for the native fruit is growing, not just in Australia, but also around the world. And there's a whole lot of work being done to make sure Kakadu plums stay in Australian hands. Stay tuned to hear more on that story very shortly. Let's kick things off in the southwest of the state, where a mining company in Greenbushes has abandoned plans to reopen a historic rail line, saying it won't be economically feasible. Talison Lithium and the WA government spent $6 million on a study to work out the cost of transporting lithium on rail instead of roads through southwest towns. ABC Southwest reporter Jackie Lynch has been following this story. Jackie, where does this leave things?
Well, basically, Georgia, with a very strong indication that the train between Greenbushes and Bunbury won't go ahead. This was Talison Lithium that runs the Greenbushes mine, lithium mine in the southwest. They have deemed the project too expensive and are backing away from that plan. They say it's not economically viable. So after years of people in the community kind of leading the charge for this to happen, it's probably the strongest indication yet that we've got that it just won't be happening.
So why is this something that the community has been calling for?
It's something that has been called for years. It really goes back. I mean, I've been here almost 10 years in the southwest, and I can't remember a time we weren't talking about the Bunbury to Greenbushes rail, but they really ramped up the calls back in 2019 when lithium started taking off and the mine was booming there, and they were looking at an expansion. So more trucks along that southwest highway and on those towns like Kirrup and Donnybrook. And so community members were calling for the lithium material to be put on rail so that they had less trucks barreling down the highway. There was concerns about safety. There was concerns about the noise, then damage to the roads. And there was a little bit of concern that this could hamper tourism in some of those towns along the highway as well. So that was the kind of argument of looking into this rail option.
Okay, so for anyone who isn't familiar with the area, can you just tell us a bit more about this railway line and which towns are actually being impacted?
Well, if anyone has been to some of these towns along the Southwest Highway in the southwest, Donnybrook, Kirrup, you would have seen a railway line. It's pretty obvious. It cuts through most of the towns. In fact, if you've been to Donnybrook, it's right on the Apple Farm Park there as well. But it hasn't been in use for more than 15 years. But it's about 78 kilometres of rail from Greenbushes to Bunbury. And like I said, it's been abandoned for about 15 years. You can still see the tracks. You can still see the crossings, but nothing's really happening. So that was the one that there was talk about it getting up and running again, but it has been idle for a very long time, so that will take quite a bit of work.
And what are Talison Lithium saying in terms of the report findings and why it's all just going to be too expensive?
Well, basically, yeah, it's going to be too expensive. The company says it is achievable to do the rail line up, but it's going to take about 3.5 years. And at the end of the day, the company says it won't even really bring that much benefit to the community, because for the first mile out of Greenbushes and the last mile into Bunbury, it's going to have to go on trucks anyway. The company didn't say what kind of cost we were talking about when it indicated that it wasn't economically viable, but we know about 6 years ago we were talking about $130 million. So with the cost of everything going up, it's probably likely to be a lot more than that now.
And so what's the reaction been like from the community since this news?
It's been mixed. Some people are not happy. They're saying that the money should be found somewhere to bring that lithium material on rail. Other people are happy. They can live with the trucks. Maybe they're not living on one of those main roads, or they've gotten used to it over the years of having them up and down. And it's not just the Talison that is sending stuff down the highway as well. It's a very busy highway. And some people are just happy that there's a decision being made, because there has been some planning decisions that have been on hold because you can't plan to put something really big where there might be a potential rail. So some people are just happy that there is an answer. And so there's just a bit of a feeling that, well, we were a bit in limbo and now we have a bit of closure and we can, I guess, start to move forward.
But the problem of extra pressure from road trains is still there, I suppose. Where to from here?
Well, I guess someone could decide to pursue the rail again. It's not just Talison, like I said, sending trucks down that highway. There has also been a local tourism group that's been calling for the rail to get underway. But now that kind of Talison has indicated it's not something that it's moving forward with, the opposition is saying it's time to move on and maybe let's put a bit more money into road safety, improving those roads, fixing them up, maybe putting some extra lanes in. I know there has been a push in the Greenbushes town site for a ring road around that town as well. So some extra road projects might be the way that Talison and the state government looks to in the future.
One to keep an eye on then. Thank you for the update, Jackie.
Thanks, Georgia.
ABC Southwest reporter Jackie Lynch. And if you are interested, you can read more on this story online. Just do a search on the ABC News website for rail dispute and you'll find Jackie's story. It's 11 past 12. If you're just tuning in, this is the WA Country Hour. Let's head to the south coast now, where the newest exporters at the Port of Esperance say they will continue to engage with the state government around potential future assistance measures. This week, Yilgarn Iron successfully sent out 176,000 tonnes of iron ore from their Coolyanobbing mine east of Southern Cross, and they sent that iron ore across to China. It comes just 5 months after the company took over the project from Mineral Resources. During their time at the helm, MinRes received around $300 million in taxpayer support to keep the mine doors open. Yilgarn Iron's Peter McBain and David Paul say while the price is looking good for the moment, they do know the market is cyclical. In the meantime, they'll celebrate their significant milestone.
It's only the first of about 25 we want to do every year, so it's an important milestone, but there's obviously plenty more to come.
And did everything go to plan?
Yes, actually, pretty much so, yeah. And I've got to commend the very helpful nature of the port and the port people and the harbour master, et cetera. So yeah, it was a great deal of assistance all the way around.
You mentioned that assistance at the port, and of course this is a shared facility that you're sharing with Gold Valley. That's the first time the Esperance Port has had to share that infrastructure. How did that relationship go?
Correct. It is a shared facility, and so what we we've got a good communication link with Golden Valley, and we share information around our laycan arrivals for the ships themselves, so we don't get each other's way, and it's in everyone's best interest to do that. And in actual fact, we're also open, as is Golden Valley, to in the future maybe a shared shipment as well, if that makes sense. So it's in a spirit of cooperation.
Peter, I might ask you this. It's been less than a year since the company took over the project, and you've been able to get things out of care and maintenance and get a ship loaded and on its way to China. That must have meant a lot of things going right at the right time.
Yeah, it's 5 months. 5 months and one day since we took over operations on site. And you're correct in saying a lot of things went right. We've got an experienced team. We've got a hard-working team. We've done great planning. We've responded and pivoted to sort of any changes, you know, as quickly as possible. You know, we communicate well with each other, and when things haven't quite worked, we've pivoted and met whatever deadline we've needed to make.
With that being said, are you on target for that? I think it was about 4 million tonne annual production?
Building towards it, and it's really in the first year, I think it's about 3.5 or maybe touch under just as we build. You know, and again, had great cooperation from our two rail providers being ARC, you know, the below, and Horizon, the above. Horizon need to build trains and have the train paths available to get to that 4.5 million tonnes. And we'll reach that sort of strike rate or that run rate. And I wonder how the test's going. We'll meet that run rate by about April of next year.
And, David, you've got to this point and sending this shipment off to China at the same time as prices are... Look, they're rising a little bit. I think they're about $105 a tonne at the moment. I mean, are you happy with where the market is at when you've reached this milestone?
Oh, certainly. I have to say it's probably a stronger market than we were anticipating. We're building this for a long-term business through the cycle. So being at the upper end of where people are expecting the price to be at the moment is, you know, obviously very helpful. We also expect it's a cycle, so that it goes up and down. But no, we're very happy where it is at the moment.
Well, that being said, I mean, were you offered or did you seek royalty relief like your predecessors, MinRes? I think there was about $300 million in taxpayer support that they received.
No, we did engage with government around other non-royalty assistance around it, and we will probably continue to do so. But given where the market is at the moment, things are margins very healthy, and also I guess it should be also fair to say we're also developing our plans to invest in the region. So our exploration, I think I talked to you about before, Tara, is kicking off in February, and that will be ongoing continuously for the next 2 years.
So, guys, as you reflect on 2025 and you look forward to 2026, how are you feeling?
Well, ticking the box. We've done what we said we're going to do, and it feels pretty good.
It does feel good, and you know, we're very pleased to have got where we are as predicted, I guess. But it's also next year, it's about that ramp up, executing that ramp up well. And then at Esperance there, you'll be seeing two Capesize vessels a month for us, and that will, you know, generate more and more revenue for the port and employment for the port. All the rail, you know, we'll be doubling our rail paths, so, you know, employment in the rail. And then, of course, back at the mine site. So I really want to execute that scale up as well as we've done so far. I think that would be a terrific outcome. Give us a call in June next year and I'll tell you how we went.
Yilgarn Iron's Peter McBain and David Paul. They were speaking with Tara de Landgraft, clearly very pleased after sending their first shipment of iron ore off to China just 5 months after taking over the project from Mineral Resources. 17 past 12, you're listening to The Country Hour this afternoon. Now, a silver and lead mine in WA's Kimberley region has finally been given the green light, more than 50 years after the deposit was first discovered. Boab Metals has approved a final investment decision for its Sorby Hills project, about 50 kilometres north of Kununurra. Managing Director and Chief Executive Simon Noon says rising silver prices helped make the decision possible.
Yeah, look, it's a lot of hard work gone in. We've obviously been involved with the project since 2018 and we've done a lot of good work. And here we are today with a fully funded project and obviously pretty excited to announce FID today.
You're saying production in the second half of 2027. So how confident are you in that timeline?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like any project, we'll no doubt meet challenges along the way. But, yeah, we're very comfortable with the target of second half of 2027.
And you mentioned the project is fully funded now and financing has been a sticking point in the past. Can you explain how the project is being funded?
It's a traditional mix of debt and equity. In the last few months, we've raised $110 million in equity and secured $236 million of debt for the project. So, yes, it's obviously a favourable environment at the moment for in particular, silver. So that's certainly give us a bit of a tailwind to get this project up and running.
What's actually happening at the site right now if you were to visit it?
We have some early works taking place, so some of the internal roads on the mining tenements are starting to take shape. Obviously, navigating the weather at this time of year, but essentially that's given us a bit of a head start into the main construction phase, which will begin, of course, in the dry next year.
You've previously mentioned housing workers in Kununurra, or you said Boab was in talks with the Shire about building some accommodation in town. What's the latest on that?
There'll be a mix of accommodation, both on site and in town. Some of that is still being worked through. We do own a camp which we purchased a couple of years ago from a gold mine in the Northern Territory. That's on site, and one of the early contracts for the project is to refurbish that accommodation facility on site. And then, as I say, there'll be some opportunities that we're trying to work through in town as well.
Does that look like a new accommodation, like a new block or a couple new blocks, or would you be housing people in existing buildings?
There'll be a mix. I couldn't tell you exactly where that's going to land at the moment.
As you do move into construction, what sort of conversations have you been having with traditional owners?
Really constructive, yeah. We collaborate regularly with Mirong Gadjurong, and we want to obviously maximise the opportunity for the local community, and that's done through, obviously, regular engagement. We've seen some competitive tenders come through MG for some of the early works, which is really encouraging to see at this early stage.
Just finally, this project has been delayed several times. What changed to allow Boab Metals to make a final investment decision this week?
I'm not sure anything's changed or it's been delayed. I mean, it's a big job getting the project to FID. And so we've naturally been working since 2018 to get the project to a level where it's financeable. Clearly, the current macroeconomic environment, and particularly, as I mentioned before, around silver, is significantly better than it was in recent years, that's for sure.
Simon Noon, he's the Managing Director and CEO of Boab Metals. He was speaking to Jess Baker after a final investment decision on the Sorby Hills Silver Lead Project was made this week. And that project, just north of Kununurra, is expected to create up to 150 jobs in construction and 140 jobs during the operation phase. 21 past 12, if you just tuned in, this is the WA Country Hour. Now, the head of an independent seafood group says a shutdown of the Pilbara demersal trawl industry will reduce the state's supply of other seafood, such as prawns, scallops and scampi. Daryl Hockey from Sustainable Seafood Australia says commercial trawl operators that catch demersal fish also operate in other fisheries, such as the Shark Bay prawn fishery. He says with the state government shutting down demersal trawlers, the future of some businesses is in doubt, and that will flow through to seafood availability.
Losing the demersal portion of their business will then make it very difficult for them to alone operate a prawning business or scallops or scampi or some of the other species that come out of the Pilbara. So it's going to make a really dramatic impact on their whole business balance and operations. Some of the boats up there will be able to keep going, but it's without doubt it's going to impact on some of the others. And that will have a flow and impact on the availability of prawns to the Perth market.
So the structure of these businesses, they will trawl for demersals, but then also trawling for prawns and scallops, scampi, those other catches, that's also part of their business as well. So essentially you're saying if you take demersals out of the equation, they may not stay in those other fisheries as well.
Each year they have seasons where they operate in different places chasing different species. So if you take out a major part of the season, which is the time that they go chasing the demersals, that means that they have to rely entirely on other species in other places at other times of the year.
Are you concerned that this ban on trawling that we saw with regards to reducing the demersal take may flow through to a ban on trawling for prawns, scallops, those particular catches as well?
Oh, look, I think if you can see the way things are going the last couple of years in Western Australia with the implementation of marine parks and various other closures, you can see what's happening now with demersal with this whole reform package, which simply doesn't make sense. Yes, of course, we're concerned down the pathway that they're going to put a lot more pressure on these fisheries, such as the one I mentioned in Shark Bay and Exmouth Gulf, where the government's already promised that they're not going to impact the commercial fishing in the new marine park. Well, you just watch what happens now. they're going to use this opportunity to go further. And before you know it, it's going to be the Abrolhos, it's going to be Rottnest Island, it's going to be all these other areas as well. So it's part of a pattern. You can see it. It's a domino effect. It's coming down our coast.
And the end result for the consumer, when do you think we'll start seeing less of these products like prawns available at the market?
Well, if they're going to implement these changes, you know, this calendar, the calendar year that's just coming up, there could well be impacts on the market by next summer. And look, it really just depends on which business is affected in what ways. But I think for sure you're going to see some impacts there. And I think, you know, the ABC has already covered the concerns of many in the community about the availability of shark to fish and chip shops, because that's very important as well. So generally, if you look at the demersal package, they've tried to achieve one thing. There's all these other knock-on consequences which they haven't taken into account, and these are going to impact on people's ability to access seafood. And so it's not just going to be a jewfish which is going to go off the plate. There's a range of other seafoods as well, and the prices will inevitably go higher.
Does this have any potential consequences for the most valuable fishery here in the lobster industry?
Well, who knows how far this government wants to go? They seem to really have it in for the fishing industry, the commercial fishing industry. Look, immediately one of the knock-on impacts that I can see is if recreationals aren't going to be able to go line fishing for demersals for the next 2 years, 21 months, a whole lot of them are going to go out there and put a whole lot more pressure on the recreational crayfish. I'm sure that you'll have boats going out there day after day after day in a row chasing the crays. Now, the cray industry is managed very sustainably at the moment, and it's not under pressure, and it can withstand some changes in pressure. But, you know, in the longer term, I'm sure that this is going to have impacts on them as well.
And, Dara, we've been talking about the sustainability concerns for demersal fish for quite some time, and you've been calling for action for some time. Action now has been taken, which you're not happy with. What do you see as the alternative here that government should have considered?
What needs to be done is to have an output model of regulation. And what I mean by that, and it's very important to listen to this, for the recreationals, they need to have a tag system. They get issued with a certain number of tags. It's an exact number, and that's all the fish that they're allowed to catch in a year. And once they run out of tags, that's it. No more fishing. And if they introduced that, two things would happen. One is you would know exactly in advance of how many fish are going to be caught for the year, so you know that it's going to be safe. Mm-hmm. And it would also allow the lifting of the ban on recreationals and commercials, and you could lift that ban now. So you would go straight to a very safe system, which everybody can share. Now, the commercials in that model would need to go to a very strict quota. Once again, each fisherman would be told exactly how many fish they're allowed to take. And once they took that many in that year, that's it. So that's a system that needs to be applied. And by doing that, that means that the supplies of seafood to the community are maintained. And at the same time, the sustainability of the fishery is tightly regulated and controlled.
It's essentially a transfer from input to output management, isn't it?
Correct. That's exactly what's needed.
Mm. And Daryl, there has been questions raised about Sustainable Seafood Australia, the group that you represent, questions around your legitimacy to have these conversations. Can you clarify who Sustainable Seafood Australia represents?
Yes, it's a group of people who have been frustrated for quite some time about the representation of primary industries, in particular in fisheries where, because recreationals are always being set against the commercials. And we believe, the whole group of us who came together to set up this organisation, that we wanted a unified focus where everybody comes together, but not just recreationals and commercials. Also, in our group, we have processors, we have people who, in the retail sector, in the process sector, in the transport section, and just in the general consumer public. And so we believe that's the type of body that needs to be formed and to be successful over time. We've been attracting a hell of a lot of support, particularly from the eastern states. In fact, we've had more response than we've been able to adequately address.
Daryl Hockey from Sustainable Seafood Australia. He was speaking to Joe Prendergast.
It is almost 12:30, which means it's news time. Jonathan Hopper, what's making headlines today?
Good afternoon, Georgia. The Prime Minister has acknowledged he could have done more to combat anti-Semitism in the wake of the deadly terror attack on Sydney's Jewish community. He's also agreed to implement the anti-Semitism report handed to the government in July in its entirety. The government will develop new laws designed to crack down on so-called hate preachers and grant additional powers to the Home Affairs Minister to cancel and reject visas. A ground and air search is underway in a continued effort to locate a 33-year-old man missing in WA's goldfields. Timothy Scanlon was last seen riding a quad bike at the edge of a salt lake approximately 35 kilometres southeast of Norseman. Anyone who has information regarding his whereabouts is urged to contact police. And two schools in WA's Midwest have closed as a precaution this morning due to smoke from a nearby fire. A fire that started at the Morrowa tip yesterday was causing black smoke that blew through the town site this morning. Morrowa District High School and the College of Agriculture have been closed for the day. Thanks, Georgia.
Thank you, Jonathan. It is 29:1.
The WA Country Hour with Georgia Hargreaves on ABC Radio WA.
Still to come between now and the next news update at 1 o'clock. Foxes are a huge problem in rural areas, but in the eastern states, one woman is taking a unique approach to helping farmers battle the invasive predators. You'll hear all about that very shortly. First, though, we've got Luke Huntington here today from the Bureau of Meteorology. Luke, let's start from the top. What's the weather doing here in the northern and eastern parts of WA?
Yes, hi Georgia. So we do have thunderstorms forecast throughout the Kimberley today. There's already some firing up through there at the moment and just over the far northern interior. And then there might just be a chance of a shower just along the coastal part of the Pilbara, but we're not expecting any thunderstorms through that area today. But the main area of thunderstorm risk is going to be sort of in the inland Gascoyne. We do have some severe thunderstorms forecast there for this afternoon, and that would be heavy rainfall. So we would put out a severe thunderstorm warning if we did see those thunderstorms. And the area of thunderstorms, probably not severe though, it also extends into just the far northwestern part of the goldfields. So places like Leinster and Wiluna would be in the firing line for those storms. And we're not expecting much sort of rainfall through the goldfields or the Pilbara area today. Most of that will be through the Kimberley and the inland Gascoyne. And then heading into tomorrow, we do see a continuation of thunderstorms throughout the Kimberley area and the far northern interior, maybe just touching on the very far east Pilbara, so they're talking about well east of Port Hedland there. And then heading down into the inland Gascoyne, once again, we've got forecast of thunderstorms through that area, but probably unlikely to get heavy rainfall through there. And also extending right throughout the Goldfields area and into the far western Eucla with not too much rainfall forecast for that area. On Saturday, the thunderstorm area does contract a little bit further east, but we're still expecting them to occur right throughout the Kimberley region, but this time extend right through most of the Pilbara. Probably west of about Onslow, you wouldn't get any thunderstorms. And then also through the inland Gascoyne, once again, through the goldfields, right throughout that Eucla region. And then on Sunday, there's a contraction back towards the north, so they'll contract out of the goldfields area. So the Kimberley, most of the Pilbara, apart from the far west, into the northeastern Gascoyne, but nothing too untoward, just typical thunderstorms for this time of year. And a similar area for Monday as well, right throughout the Kimberley, most of the Pilbara and interior, and also through the inland Gascoyne.
Okay, thank you for that. And what about further south of the state? What can we expect?
Further south, we do have a new high-pressure ridge coming in, so just in the onshore flow in the southern districts, we are seeing just a chance of a shower today, probably just east of Albany, along the coast there, right across to Esperance and Israelite Bay, but very, very light and isolated showers, so not really too much in it. But otherwise, it's pretty clear for the Southwest Land Division today. Heading into tomorrow, it's a different story. We do have a trough developing through the area, so it's bringing a little bit more moisture and some thunderstorms into the area. So right throughout the southwest, the central west district, the wheat belt into the eastern Great Southern, right down into Esperance, we're looking at a risk of thunderstorms. Maybe a slight chance in the early morning, or in the morning period, but mostly into the afternoon period will be the risk of those storms. And there's not really too much rainfall associated with them. So again, dry lightning is possible with storms through that area tomorrow afternoon. So that's not, doesn't bode well well for risk of any dry lightning starting any bushfires through that region. Into Saturday, the area does contract slightly eastwards, so we're looking at the very far eastern wheat belt into the Esperance region for any thunderstorms. Again, not too much rainfall associated with those storms. And Sunday, we do see sort of those thunderstorms contract out of the Southwest Land Division, so we're not expecting any, pretty much no rainfall through that Southwest Land Division on Sunday. And then on Monday, we do have a weak cold front clipping the south coast, so that'll probably be the only rainfall for the Southwest Land Division south of about Margaret River across to Israelite Bay, just some very isolated light showers.
Thank you for the update, Luke. It's 25-1 on the Country Hour. Richard Hudson has been watching the cricket closely, but hopefully you've got some rainfall figures for us too.
Oh, old Dibby Dobber, good on you. Not too much rain to report on. In the Kimberley, Charnley River and Winjana Gorge, 5 mils. Curtin Airport, 6. And then in the Gascoyne, Meekatharra had 7 mils. And nowhere else in the whole of Western Australia had 5 mils or above, so there wasn't too much around. But after all of the fires that we've been covering in the week so far, Georgia, it's nice to glance at the Emergency WA website and see that none of the fires in the state at the moment are above an advice level. A fair few are still at a bushfire advice level, but there are a few other warnings to do with that fire that's at the tip at that's just towards the Morrowa town site. And there's also a smoke warning for the Shire of Augusta, Margaret River. But all the details are on the Emergency WA website. Just put those two words into your search engine. Easy to find. The most important and serious warnings are always at the top. And if you're on the move, just download the Emergency WA app and everything's there. But on the topic of fires, the Great Southern community is coming to terms with the death of a 34-year-old man who lost his life after fighting a bushfire on Tuesday at Mindarabin near Ongerup. And as we've been reporting, we understand a branch from a fire-affected tree fell on his car. And it's only been about 3 weeks since Ravensthorpe farmer Mark Moody died fighting a fire on farmland in the West River area. So Ngarrindjeri President Kate O'Keefe says that the tragic news of all of this is still being absorbed by the wider community.
Absolutely. I think coming off the back of the tragic accident at the Ravensthorpe fire, this is everyone's worst nightmare when they go into a fire event. Everyone works very, very hard to make sure that everyone gets home safely. So as far as the community goes, I'm sure there is just genuine sadness for the fact that after an incredible community effort to rally and put out a fire of that magnitude, the evening ended with such a tragic accident, and we are just collectively so sad for the family of the victim.
And WA Farmers President Steve Maguire also offers his condolences to the family and friends of those who've lost their lives trying to fight these recent fires.
Oh, look, it's just terrible. Absolutely terrible. One's bad enough and two's twice as bad. Now, we all know that fighting fires is an inherently dangerous practice, and it's what we have to do it. It's what we all get in and pitch in and help out. You know, we're careful, but it is dangerous, and you try your best to keep it out of trouble. But we've all had lots of close calls, I'm sure of us, all had fighting fires. But unfortunately, sometimes you just wrong place, wrong time. But I had a tree fall across in front of the ute when I was mopping up a year or two ago, and it sort of makes you think, completely out of the blue. So you think you're careful, you think you're safe, and sometimes it just can come up behind you. You don't even know. You're not unsuspecting, and you think you've done the right thing, and you're still in a dangerous situation. So it's just terribly, terribly unlucky, I feel. get around them, same as 2 weeks ago. You know, it's letting them know that they're a special person, that they meant something to you, that they're a good person, and that, you know, you can help out any way you can. But in the end, you know, grief's a pretty lonely business, so all we can do is help them through it.
Kojuna farmer Steve Maguire, who's president of WA Farmers. And unfortunately, in some more sad news, CBH Chief Operations Officer Mick Dore has issued a statement saying a serious suspected medical episode involving a valued CBH team member occurred at the CBH Avon site on Tuesday afternoon, and tragically the person has passed away. His next of kin and family have been notified, and Mick Dore says deepest condolences go to his family and loved ones, friends and team members during the extremely difficult time. So yeah, our thoughts are with them as well.
Very sad news there. Thank you for the update, Richard. It is 21 to 1. This is the Country Hour. And they're seen as a bit of a superfood, and the market for Kakadu plums is growing, not just in Australia, but around the world. Right now, the biggest producers of the native yellow green fruit are Aboriginal enterprises and communities in northern Australia. Paul Sakey heads up NACPA, the Northern Australia Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance Co-op. He says there's a whole lot of work being done to make sure that this increasingly popular native fruit stays in Australian hands.
A Kakadu plum is a fruit that's endemic to northern Australia. So by that, it's only really found in northern Australia. It's quite popular internationally, very well known for its high levels of vitamin C. It's reputed to have the highest level of vitamin C of any fruit. It's very popular in nutraceuticals and also very popular in cosmetic products, quite simply focused on its vitamin C and its antioxidant properties.
There's an awful lot of science being done around the Kakadu plum at the moment. What is some of that science looking at?
So a lot of the science that we're focused on is really around provenance, being able to identify where fruit comes from, whether it is actually produced by an indigenous producer, and also in terms of what are its nutritional properties and what are its nutritional characteristics.
Why have you been really getting involved with this traceability and sort of proof of origin science? Why is that important for the industry?
It's really important for Indigenous producers. There's a lot of blackwashing that goes on in mainstream markets, particularly in Australia, around the bush food stories. But certainly we're noticing internationally that there are a lot of overseas Kakadu plum extracts which are not real. So there's a lot of fake products in circulation internationally. And having a robust provenance technology to be able to prove where something actually comes from and to be able to prove that it is produced by an Indigenous producer is really important in securing and guaranteeing market share for Indigenous producers.
There's also a lot of work around sort of protecting the species and protecting the origins of the Kakadu plum trees. What have we learned from history about why that's important?
History has shown that a lot of endemic bush foods have actually gone overseas. Macadamia nuts is probably one that everybody knows. But similarly, we're seeing the same sort of thing happen to bush foods like lemon myrtle and also finger limes.
For Indigenous communities in the north of Australia, what is the Kakadu plum industry worth, I guess, from a dollar value, but also from a cultural perspective?
From a cultural perspective, it's really difficult to put a dollar value on cultural value of Kakadu plum. Kakadu plum is known by many names depending on which community is using it and which language group. I think its cultural significance is that it's connected to culture. It's really tied to country as well. And having an active engagement with Kakadu plum and other bush foods really does help preserve Indigenous culture and Indigenous knowledge. In terms of its commercial value at the moment, in the past, in places like Wadair, harvesters have been paid something like $140,000 in a harvest season that's distributed amongst, 100 to 200 women in a small town of, say, 2,000 people. It certainly makes a big contribution to, has a multiplier effect, if you like, in terms of the local economy. And the great thing about it is that it's actually harvested from country. So it's actually utilising an existing resource that is already there.
In terms of the alliance, which you head up, do you have any plans to move towards a sort of traditional agricultural co-op model of helping to distribute the Kakadu plum?
We do have, there's a few members have got a couple of different ideas about how the NACPA cooperative might operate in the future, sort of a hybrid model of a distributive co-op that would actually buy fruit from its producers, go to market, and then if it does achieve a higher price, to distribute that surplus back to members, but whilst also providing other services such as technical support, laboratory testing, food safety, HACCP food planning, also supply chain management, and also business development to help source new customers for bush food products.
If you do find new customers for the Kakadu plum, are you looking to also increase the amount of fruit that you can offer?
Yeah, so currently our estimations are that a very small amount, a small percentage of what's actually available out on Wild Harvest is actually harvested. It does take a fair bit of coordination and a bit of effort to organise Wild Harvest, but we certainly think that as communities build more capacity, that they should really be able to increase production of Wild Harvest bush foods considerably into the future.
Paul Sakey from NACPA, which is the Northern Australia Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance Co-op, and he was speaking with Fiona Broom. Now, I just want to test something out and see who is actually listening to this digital version of the Country Hour. If you are listening, can you do me a favour and text in, tell me whether or not you've tried Kakadu plums before? I'm interested to know. 0448 922 604 is the number. I've actually never tried them, but I do weirdly have a sunscreen that's Kakadu plum flavour, and it smells delicious. 0448 922 604 is that number again, if you'd like to let me know that you are in fact listening. Now, as you'll probably know, foxes are a huge problem in rural areas. But in the eastern states, one woman is taking a pretty unique approach to helping farmers battle the invasive predators. Emily Middleton has this story.
6 months ago, Emma Sinclair didn't know how to sew a button. Now she's crafting clothing out of fox fur.
I spent about 2 months in Paris in a basement atelier learning how to sew and learning how to work with fur, and was able to bring those skills back home with me to Australia and use that to start the brand.
Emma has always had a passion for native Australian wildlife. She's currently studying her master's in biodiversity conservation. And after seeing the direct impact invasive species like the red Australian fox was having on native mammals, she knew she had to do something.
It's been quite harrowing watching the impact of invasive species on our native wildlife, of, you know, seeing captive breeding programs that are really successful, but knowing that the animals can't really be released into the Australian landscape because they will just be eaten almost immediately by foxes and cats. So it's quite disheartening being a conservationist, knowing that we're up against that battle. We've lost 14 mammal species to foxes. 75 are currently under threat. So it's a dire situation.
But getting to this point hasn't been a walk in the park. Emma, who was originally from inner city Melbourne, is generally very against farmed fur or the fur clothing industry. However, with the invasive fox causing vast devastation across the country, she wanted to do something with the pelt of the animal that was otherwise rotting in a farmer's paddock.
When I had this idea of, you know, working with fur and creating clothing, I looked around Australia to see if I could learn how to work with fur here, and the fur industry doesn't exist anymore, which I think is a very good thing because I'm generally very against farmed fur and hunting animals for fur in their endemic ranges, but needed to learn. So I happened to be in Europe for a wedding, and I was meant to be in Paris for 3 days, and I thought, well, the worst thing people can say to me is no. So I just door knocked. I walked all over Paris introducing myself to anyone that was vaguely in the fur trade, and through my broken French, explained my concept and what I was wanting to do, and I was incredibly humbled that people were very, very open and generous with their knowledge and expertise. So I met an incredible woman called Fabienne, who is Paris-based, and I walked into her shop and I explained my concept, and she said, "Okay, Emma, well, we start tomorrow." I said, "Oh, okay." So I ended up extending my trip so I could work in her atelier and learn how to sew. It was necessary.
It was now a matter of finding foxes that could be killed in the most humane way.
I started reaching out to farmers. So I'm Canberra-based at the moment, so I was reaching out to farmers around Yass and around Bungendore, Braidwood Way, and just started having conversations about what is the situation on your land with foxes, and started hearing the most harrowing stories of, you know, people's whole livelihoods just being absolutely destroyed. So with the price of a lamb being around $400 at the moment, I've heard stories of foxes taking out 50 lambs a year. So there's a lot of incentive to remove foxes, but it can be costly and there's a lot involved there. So I kind of reached out to some local conservation-focused hunters, as I think it's perhaps the most humane way to dispatch the fox. Very important to me that the welfare is there and it's as painless and quick as possible. So I started coming along to farmers' properties that were, through desperation, really just opening their doors and saying, "Please help us." I'd bring hunters along and we'd harvest fox pelts, knowing that, you know, less foxes is, you know, serving the farmers and also hopefully the wildlife around as well. So then that opened the door of tanning, which is, there's not much of a tanning industry in Australia anymore. So connecting with the kind of last couple of tanners around Australia and learning about the different chemicals used and really having to keep my sustainability and environmental ethics kind of at my core there, with choosing to use environmentally friendly tanning methods and steering away from the really heavy chemicals, because I don't want to betray the message of the brand, that it being reusing and recycling and keeping things as environmentally light as possible. I think it would be harmful to then use some heavy chemicals to tan the pelts.
Wanting to be part of every step of the process, that meant Emma had to get her hands dirty.
I'm a city girl, I'm from Melbourne, so this was a very kind of new world for me. But I think going into conservation, it's really important to sit in the discomfort of that. You know, we can be in the air conditioning in the city, talking about what it's like in the bush and what is happening to our ecosystems, without having any actual understanding and hands-on experience. And also really important for me with Almanac to be able to stand behind every single step of the process. So when I put a product in someone's hands, I can explain every single part of how that beanie or, you know, coat, when it comes to it, came to be.
Now, Emma is working on launching her first product, a merino beanie with a fox fur pom-pom. And having to explain her story to a wide audience, she's found a few differing responses.
When I'm talking to someone from the city who's a bit, you know, removed from the landscape and living kind of within ecosystems, I'm talking about the ethics and I'm talking about, you know, how my project is not the traditional fur industry. I'm not wanting to revive, you know, an industry that I'm very glad has closed. This is a really hyper-specific situation that, you know, is it's different. And I'll talk about the ethics and I'll explain extinction rates and I'll kind of go over that. Whereas when I talk to farmers, they say, "Em, you know, we don't need to hear all your justifications, we're on board," you know. And it's different ways of framing this to different people and how they see the situation. And I find that most people, you know, when they hear about the gravity of the impact of foxes and knowing that it's a legal duty in most states in Australia to remove foxes from your land, that, you know, they're currently just disintegrating where they fall, using that material is really the right thing to do. And I think most people see that and can sit in the nuance of this very complex story.
Conservationist Emma Sinclair, she was speaking to Emily Middleton. And if you want to check out that beanie, just search ABC Rural and Fox and you should find Emma's story. It is 7 minutes to one on the Country Hour, and I've got a couple of texts come through about my call out asking whether or not you've tried Kakadu plums before. Dave says, nope, never tried or seen the plum that I'm aware of. Well, you and me are the same, Dave. And good to hear from you, David from Anna Plains Station. He also has not tried Kakadu plum. There you go. Now, over to the Northern Territory, where an unusual crop is being grown in the middle of the desert, about 140 kilometres north of Alice Springs. The Southern Barkly region is known mostly for buffel grass, native plants and the odd tree. But this year, for the first time, farmers Anthony and Danielle Haig have had a crack at growing barley, and they've almost finished harvest.
Yeah, so we're just in the tractor here now, just cutting this barley hay, getting ready for it to be baled and that. Yeah, it's always good to see big green circles out here. It's not something you see in the middle of the desert anyway. So this will all get mowed today, and then we'll sit for a day and we'll rake it and let it cure for a couple of days, and then we'll bale it then.
Amidst the hundreds of kilometres of red dirt, termite mounds and buffel grass in the Southern Barkly, you'll likely be surprised to hear that 34 hectares of barley is being grown at Athel Outback Hideaway. I jumped out of the tractor with owner Anthony Haig to learn more about why they're growing barley in the Barkly.
Yeah, so this is the first time we've planted barley here. This is a new crop what we've planted now. We just put the barley in to get a bit of cover in here and get that extra cut during the year. But yeah, once we cut and barley it, all our roads will come through then.
Now, we've got to ask a little bit about why you've decided to plant barley. It's obviously a first view. What was the push behind that?
So we planted the barley just because we're a little bit late at planting. When we wanted to put oats into it, but we were a little bit late. So we've gone with the barley because it'll tolerate a bit more heat towards the end of winter. So that was our choice behind that.
We're coming now to cutting it, getting that harvest in. It will be done today. How has it performed and how has it been growing out here?
Performance-wise, I think it's done pretty good, but we didn't know what to expect from it because it hasn't been grown out here before. Yeah, it's probably not the best crop of barley, but it's something we can do with. We would have liked to get probably 5 ton to a hectare, but I reckon it'll probably go 4 ton to a hectare. But like I said, it's all trial and error, and we'll see how we go with it.
Has that heat maybe caused it to come through a bit early, maybe lessening that, you know, ton per hectare?
Yeah, probably that heat's coming a bit quicker, which is wanting to send it to seed, so that's why we're cutting it before it goes to seed.
It's obviously a bit of a unique one. I was chatting to a few people before I came up here and they were pretty shocked to hear about barley in the Red Centre. Do you think that the barley has a future here at Athel Outback Hideaway amongst the red dirt?
Yeah, it probably sounds a bit weird growing crops out in the desert, but we've got the water here, so we're going to use it. So if you've got water and a bit of fertiliser, you can virtually grow anything.
In terms of that water licence and that water usage, how much of that has this sort of taken up going for the barley and doing the cropping out here?
So we're probably at about 50-60% of our water usage at the moment. We've still got a bit more room to expand, so we'll see what happens in the next couple of years. To expand it, obviously we're going to have to put in some more pivots, a few more pumps and that, pump a bit more water. And yeah, by the time we get a few more pivots in, it should be a pretty productive place.
And I guess the question is now, where is this going and what will this barley be used for?
So this barley will be all used for cow hay or horse hay, and it's all virtually sold in the Northern Territory. So when we come here we had 2 pivots and we sold it all out straight away, all the hay, and then we've been slowly building it more and more, and the demand's just getting bigger and in the Northern Territory, so they're not having to freight it from down south or over the coast somewhere, so their freight bills are down a bit, so yeah.
Athel Outback Hideaway owners Danielle and Anthony Haig, ending that story from Charles Geary. And you can read more about this Outback barley crop online. Just search ABC Alice Springs and barley. There's a few words there that you wouldn't normally search for. Now, there were 883 head of weaner cattle sold at the Mount Barker sale yards this morning, and Tracy Kilner has the prices for you.
An excellent quality yarding saw most categories trend up with the lighter numbers on offer.
Feeder buyers were again chasing heavyweights, while grass-fed and background steers and heifers were in demand. Heavy steer calves reached a top of 474 cents, while the lightweight heifers sold up to 414 cents a kilo. Extra heavyweight weaner steers weighing over 380 kilos sold from 410 to 472 cents. Heavyweights over 330 kilos made 400 to 474 cents. Lightweights from 280 kilos returned 414 to 540 cents. And weights under 280 kilos sold from 456 to 540 cents. The extra heavyweight weaner heifers weighing over 380 kilos returned 386 to 432 cents. Heavyweights over 330 kilos sold from 350 to 412 cents. Lighter weight heifers over 280 kilos made 350 to 382. And the under 280 kilo heifers returned 384 to 414 cents. Bullies sold to feeder buyers for 290 to 332 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kuehner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. It is almost time for the next news update, but I just want to get a couple of texts in before then. This one's from Angus in Cunderdon. He says, Georgia, I love my kakadus. That's in reference to kakadu plums. And this one, hey, I've had kakadu plum before at my property in Catherine in the NT. Thank you for that text. And just letting you know as well, the first Mount Barker sale for 2026 will be a two-day sale on January 8th and 9th. Thanks for your company this afternoon. News time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.